Welcome to the Crazy Wisdom Podcast. This podcast is for you if you have an insane drive to find the truth of things. It's not the good answers that we seek, but the good questions. I interview a range of different guests from many different fields, all with the intention to uncover the simple truths that are hidden in plain sight. Most people don't want to go there. I go there. My guests go there, and you benefit. Please let me know if you enjoy these episodes, and as always, subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to the podcast. Welcome to the Crazy Wisdom Podcast. My guest today is Stephen Wolfram. He is a founder and CEO of Wolfram Research, and very excited to have you on the show. Welcome.
Thanks.
So, there's a lot we can talk about. We can talk about AI. We did an interview back in 2018, and the big thing I got from that interview is that once computers figure out how to do what we want, then we have to figure out what we actually want, which is a very tricky philosophical question for a lot of human beings. And it turns out you're right, because the AI, now that I've been using AI and working at an AI company, it's true. It's able to do a lot of the things, not everything. And that might be a good question for you, is like, how close are we to the point where it really can do whatever we want? Let's start with that. How close are we to that?
Well, okay. I think we should start in a different place, because I think we last talked, as you say, 2018, 2019, something like that.
Yes.
Several big things have happened in my world and in the world in general since that time. And the thing that was sort of the big surprise for me was I had been sort of interested. I'd worked in physics a long time ago. I had made progress in some ideas about sort of foundations of physics back in the early 1990s. And then in late 2019, I decided, okay, I've been thinking I will work on the fundamental theory of physics sometime in my life. If I'm ever going to do it, it's time's running out. I've got to do it now. So with a couple of young physicists, started working on kind of developing the ideas that I'd had in the early 1990s. And the really amazing thing was they worked. And, which I have to say, I was kind of thinking we were looking at a century long kind of sequence of steps and so on. But instead, in late 2019, kind of all kinds of things just started falling into place. It was really cool. And the thing that was a little weird was we were just ready to announce this in March of 2020. Then the world shut down. And actually, it wasn't so bad, because, by the time we were doing April, we were sort of talking about what we'd done and doing live streams about it and so on. And I think maybe people didn't have anything else to do. So that probably led to more, people being interested in physics. But so that's one sort of big thing we can talk about, what's been in that physics project. But that then turns out, I didn't think, again, I thought, doing this physics project, figuring out fundamental theory of physics, there'll be no application of that for 200 years, I said. But it turns out that was wrong too, because it turns out that we realized that the formalism that we developed for the physics project has all kinds of applications in other places. And that's in both, whether it's in foundational things about metamathematics, or things about distributed computing, things about thinking about AI and machine learning and so on. There's just a whole bunch of applications of that, these kind of foundational ideas. So that's been another sort of big adventure, and that's led to something else, which is I'd sort of been, a lot of things I've done in science have had sort of some philosophical implications, but it's turned out that the things that have come out of the physics project are great big kind of, people thought about this 1,000 years ago and didn't get anywhere with it, but now we actually have something to say about it, kinds of questions.
What are some of those? What are the questions that you got?
Like, why does the universe exist? It's a good question. Or things like, are the laws of physics inevitable? These are, is it inevitable that the universe seems to have regularity? Or is that something that sort of needs a creator to have the universe have regularity, things
like
that.
What do you mean by regularity?
So could be the case that we couldn't predict anything about what would happen. In other words, if we look at little computational systems, we'll often get things that where the little computational system, when we run it, It just does all these really complicated things that look completely random to us. But the fact is that our human experiences, there are predictable features of the universe. There seems to be sort of a design to the universe. There are laws of physics that apply here and everywhere type thing. And there's sort of a question of why does it work that way? And one of the things that's become clear from things we've been doing in recent times is the reason the universe looks the way it does to us is because we are the way we are. In other words, there are sort of observers of it. I mean, this is a long story, and we have to go pretty deep in a rabbit hole to kind of see how this works. But to give some sort of indication of what how the sort of the logical flow here, and talking about sort of what the sort of the big surprise of we built a bunch of science that's based on sort of questions about fundamental physics and so on, and now it turns out we can address these kind of very old and deep philosophical questions in a kind of a modern scientific way. So that's all been a big surprise. Then a year or so ago, the LLMs arrived, and that was a surprise for everybody, including the people who've been working on them. I mean, I had been sort of paying attention to what was happening there and thought nothing interesting was happening. And so when the LLMs got to the point of being able to write a coherent essay, that was a big surprise. So I spent some effort trying to figure out why does this work? What's really going on? And actually wrote a little book about that, which seems to have been quite popular. That's sort of been a separate story. And now this whole question about sort of what's fundamentally going on in an LLM or one of these AI systems is something which just very recently, last couple of months, I've realized a bunch of things that we figured out from our physics project actually start to tell you things about sort of the bigger picture of why things like AIs and neural nets and LLMs and so on work. So that it's been for me, there's both at the level of I didn't expect this physics project was going to work nearly as well as it has. I think we can really say with some degree of certainty that we kind of know what the fundamental infrastructure of the physical world is, and that it has to be the way it is.
So what is the, this might be a large question, but what is the fundamental way that the universe works?
Right. So, I mean, the place to start is say, sort of, what's the universe made of? And people, you go back a couple thousand years, people are arguing, is it made of discrete atoms? Is it made of continuous things that flow? Lots of discussion about that. Okay. By the end of the 1800s, for matter, that was nailed down. Matter is made of atoms and it's discrete. Then, rather soon thereafter, people realized, okay, light is made of discrete, or can be thought of as made of discrete things, photons. Space, people imagined at the time, okay, everything's going to be discrete. The atomists are going to be right all the way down. Space is going to be discrete as well. But at the time, people couldn't figure out sort of technically how to make that work. So then for 100 years, people assumed that there's no structure to space. Space is continuous. You can describe things like its curvature, but it doesn't, there's no underlying sort of structure underneath space. And so the kind of starting point of our physics project is, well, actually, no, that's not right. Space is made of discrete elements. We can think of them as atoms of space, and there's just a bunch of points. And the only thing we know about them is how these points are related to each other. So we're basically building up this big graph. It's kind of the friend network of the atoms of space. And so everything in the universe is just a feature of that giant network. And so, for example, oh, something like an electron, we don't know exactly how that works yet, but it's some kind of thing like you'd see, an eddy in water. The little molecules are down there doing what they do, but there's this overall, circulation that has some stability. And that's kind of how things like particles presumably work. We do know in much more detail how black holes work in our models. And we can kind of see there's this black hole that's a feature of this network. And we can see, you take two black holes, they'll eventually merge with each other. They produce gravitational radiation. It's all very cool and very much what is actually observed in physical experiments. So the sort of starting point is, the universe is made of everything in the universe is a feature of space. Space is the only thing in the universe. And
And
the,
now
yeah,
space.
yeah.
Space, do you mean? I assume that you mean not necessarily outer space, but just like all of space.
Yeah, space as in the thing that we exist in, where we can say we put something this place or that place. And so there's sort of a question of whether there is in the universe different kinds of things. Like there's, you put things at these places, but the things you put there are not like the space that you're putting them into. There, you know, it could be the case that matter is something fundamentally different from space. That has been the kind of the belief.
And so does ma when you place something inside of empty space, does that replace the empty space with something else?
There isn't any empty space.
There is no
The
empty space.
only thing that the only thing that exists in the universe is this big network. The network is not
Whoa. Okay.
embedded in anything else. It's just that network makes space and everything in space.
Got it.
So one of the things that's a little bit of a downer for our sort of feeling of importance in the universe is it seems like if you look at what's happening in the universe, this network that represents the space and everything in it is continually being rewritten. It's continually sort of little pieces of it are changing, and it's and that's happening, you know, that's happening all the time, so to speak. And if you look at all that activity, basically the overwhelming majority of what's happening is just knitting together the structure of space. Only maybe one part in 10 to the 120 of the things that are happening are things that are the things we care about, like, oh, there's an electron here, there's a photon here, and so on. Most of what's happening in the universe is just maintaining the structure of space. And when and the you know the thing that we'd really like to see is there may be some extreme situations related to black holes where that structure of space begins to you can see that it is constructed of something. You can see that it's made of discrete elements. And that's kind of the one of the next frontiers is to kind of understand that. But this is so kind of the first step is space is everything in the universe is made of this giant network. Time is the kind of computational progression of this network. You're kind of saying,
Interesting.
so you know, in people have kind of imagined for the last 100 years or so that space and time are very much the same kind of thing, which is not our common experience. But it is something which one has been able to force fit into the mathematics of what's going on. But turns out that really isn't a very good idea. And actually, time is this kind of continual computational progression from this sort of state of the universe to the next one, and so on. Space is kind of this extent of this big graph of different atoms of space. So that then, you know, what's non-trivial then is that things like relativity emerge. It's kind of like the following thing. If you look at a bunch of molecules bouncing around, it doesn't matter actually too much what the details of those molecules are, so long as they have certain overall properties. The aggregate of all those molecules bouncing around gives you something like a fluid like water, or air for that matter. And it turns out that when you have all these atoms of space and they're all getting rewritten and this network is changing and so on, the aggregate thing that you get out is the structure of space-time that we've known from the Einstein equations and general relativity and all these kinds of things. So it's kind of like from all this microscopic stuff that's going on emerges what we currently know about space-time. So anyway, this is a whole elaborate story of how one gets kind of phenomena like gravity, and then there's a sort of separate story of how one gets quantum mechanics, which turns out to be completely inevitable. I mean, the fundamental difference between classical mechanics and quantum mechanics is in classical mechanics, definite things always happen. Like you throw a ball, goes in a definite trajectory. In quantum mechanics, it's like there are many possible paths, and we only get to talk about the probabilities of the outcomes from those different paths. Well, it turns out in these models, what happens is this network is getting rewritten, but there are many different ways it can get rewritten. So there are many paths of history that form.
Yeah, got it.
You
Interesting.
branch different paths of history, the paths of history can merge, and so on. And And one of the features, so it's not obvious if there's this giant network that represents space, the question is, why do we think space is continuous? Well, the reason we think space is continuous is because we are observing only a very aggregated version of this. We're not observing those individual atoms of space. We're only seeing, just like in a fluid, we don't see the water molecules, we just see the overall flow of lots and lots of water molecules. So that's kind of why we observe that the fact that we are sort of big compared to the atoms of space is why we, and that we don't sort of, we're not sensitive to all these details, is why we observe space as this apparently continuous thing. Well, in quantum mechanics, what seems to be happening is that all these different paths of history, we are, our brains also follow many paths of history. And so, in a sense, what we have to ask about our perception of the universe is, how does a brain that follows many paths of history perceive the universe, which is following many paths of history? And so our brains effectively span many paths of history. And the big assumption that we make is that definite things happen. So it's not obvious, you know, we could, our brains could be set up so that we could continuously be thinking many different things are going on at the same time, but that's not how we're set up. We believe that we, the, you know, we observe a single sort of thread of history. And that's what kind of drives the how quantum mechanics works and so on. And we can kind of, we're gradually unpacking more and more of kind of what makes all the phenomena of quantum mechanics and so on work the way they do. And it's I mean, this is, you know, the thing that's really exciting about this to me, there are a couple of things. One is that usually you make models of stuff, and you know, as you think about more different kinds of things, you say, well, I got to add this little twiddle onto this model. I've got to change this in this way. So far, you know, we're what, 4 years into this now. And, you know, so far there's no hacks. It's just, it's hard to figure out what the consequences of the model are, but there's no place where we've said, oops, you know, we have to add this little twiddle to the model to
Oh,
work,
interesting.
which is just, it's pretty much unprecedented. I mean, it's that, that's the, you know, in, if you're in like physics business or something, when you have a model which manages to explain all these things and you never had to tweak the model, it's really incredibly good evidence that you nailed it.
And this is also with other people trying to replicate your same results as well. They also can't add anything.
Well, yeah, I mean, there are a bunch of people working on this, but it's kind of a this is one of the nice features of kind of computational work and so on. It's like, you know, the things I write, there's a picture in it. You click the picture, you get a piece of Wolfram language code, you run it on your computer, it makes that picture.
Got
It's not
it.
like, it's not like it's, you know, was the mouse unhappy that day, so that's why it twitched its whiskers in that way. No, it's, you know, this is profoundly reproducible science, so to speak. Now, I mean, you know, you can, I think that. So that's the, I mean, it's an interesting phenomenon actually, because the what's, you know, this is a very different way of thinking about how physics works, but it turns out that a lot of the approaches that people have taken in mathematical physics in the last, I don't know, 30, 40 years plug into this. There are various limits of this. There are, you know, different approaches, causal set theory, spin networks, string theory, probably. They all kind of end up being limits of what we're talking about. So it's kind of like, in this special case, you get that theory. In this special case, you get that theory, which is again very encouraging. I mean, it's kind of like people, it turns out people were not barking up the wrong tree. They just went, you know, they just were on a particular piece of the tree. And, you know, we're seeing a bigger part of the tree. But it's also a lot of things that had seemed very arbitrary and abstract end up seeming kind of inevitable given our models. And that's also sort of exciting. But I think the thing that is probably the single most remarkable thing for me is this question of, okay, so we might have a model for physics. Why is it that model and not another model? So this was a, you know, we might imagine there's some simple rule that reproduces all the physical world. Why did we get that rule and not another rule? How do we explain that? And what we realized is that just as in quantum mechanics, we're looking at many different paths of history, so it turns out there's this much bigger sort of object, which we call the Ruliad, which is this thing that looks at all possible rules that are being applied. So usually you do a computation. You have, let's say, an idealized computation, a Turing machine, or you have an actual computer doing computation. It just follows a particular set of rules and does a particular thing. But imagine that you had all possible, Turing machines, all possible sort of instruction sets for a computer. You started off and it's running with all these different possibilities. And sometimes sort of two possibilities will lead to two different outcomes. Sometimes those two different outcomes will actually merge together when you apply some yet different set of rules. So you get this kind of complicated branching, merging object that is kind of the entangled limit of all possible computations. It's kind of an object that people could have studied before. And actually, I and other people sort of surprised nobody ever looked at this before. It is a big, it's a big complicated object, but that is the inevitable thing. That is, if you're interested in kind of how to think about things computationally, this is the whole shebang. It's everything that is computationally possible, all kind of entangled together.
What is
And then,
not computationally possible? Like, how do we know that? And like, what can we not compute? What is beyond the realm of compute?
Well, so if you have a computer as we know it, and we have this notion of universal computation, that there is a computer like the typical computers we use, which, if fed the right software, can be made to do anything else, including emulate any other kind of computer. Okay, so that's all fine. But then, if we ask the question, what will that universal computer do after an infinite amount of time? How do we figure that out? Well, we've got another universal computer that can try and figure it out, but that's equivalent to the first universal computer. So we'll never be able to break that infinity. It's going to take an infinite time. So these questions that are where we say, what will the thing do after an infinite time? Those are questions that are not accessible to a computer of the time of the kind we imagine. Now, you could just say, I'm going to have a special box and I'm going to store the results of these infinite computations in that box. I don't know how I got them, but I'm just going to store these results. And then I can sort of attach that to my computer. And now I have a hypercomputer that can do more than my computer can do. So the kind of one of the sort of the claims, the statements is, our universe is merely computational and not hypercomputational. In other words, it could be the case that our universe is able to do hypercomputations, but it doesn't seem to be able to. And actually, in the way that our model works out, if there was this Rouliad thing just deals with computations, there are an infinite collection of hyper-Rouliads that can do hypercomputation. But if you are in the Rouliad, if you are sort of embedded within the Rouliad, you will never be able to communicate with any hyper-Rouliad. There's kind of an event horizon that prevents you from doing that. And so, in other words, the hyper-Rouliad, the question of whether it even exists, is not particularly worth talking about because you'll never see evidence of that.
Okay, so this gets into the AI stuff, which is that you did a talk, I think it was last week, where I was on Twitter and I randomly came upon it, and it was extremely interesting. And one thing that really hit me was that we have scientific narratives. We can't understand something until we have a narrative for it that's been backed up by this research. And then if AI can actually create some things that are totally new, and I assume that they're creating or they're finding something in this Rouliad that you're space that you're talking about, if they can do that, if we have no narrative for it, we can't understand it. Is that accurate? And what is the implication of that?
Well, I mean, the first thing to realize is, even in the Rouliad, for example, there's a lot of stuff that's going on. Most of it we don't care about. I mean, I've spent some large part of my life studying simple computational systems and what they do. Okay. Now, those simple computational systems were not built for an engineering purpose. They were just sampled at random from the set of all possibilities, or enumerated from a whole set of possibilities. And one of the big discoveries that I made in the early 80s is that even when the rules for that system are extremely simple, what it does can be very complicated. But what it does may be something where we say, oh yes, that's very complicated, and we don't have anything human to talk about with it. Sometimes we can take that complexity and use it for some human purpose. Like we can say it's a good generator of randomness or approximate randomness or something, or it's a good thing for doing this kind of discrimination between this kind of input and that kind of input. But we don't, but so the thing that, you know, what's out there in the computational universe, there's an infinite set of things out there. They're very rich. Some of them we care about, most we don't. Now, what is something that we care about? Well, it's something that we've kind of, that has become familiar to us. So, you know, even if we look at, I don't know, different periods of art or something, you know, what might be an artistic thing in this period, to somebody in a different period, it's like, that's just a bunch of random paint splodges. And it's, you know, we see that in kind of scientific kinds of things. But a classic example is fractal patterns, nested patterns, where, you know, when people first invented those in the 1200s, it's like, you know, well, they're kind of cool looking. But there's, you know, for example, the art historians, when they were describing mosaics that had been made in the 1200s that had these nested patterns, they didn't even mention them. They just were talking about other features. They didn't, whereas if today, the art historians would say, oh, it's got a fractal pattern in it, because that's become a thing that's part of our kind of way of talking about things. And so this question.
Go for it.
Yeah, I mean, this question of sort of what's out there in the computational universe versus what have we humans kind of brought humanized is an interesting one. I mean, I did a little experiment a while ago, a few months ago, just looking at generative AI systems, where you say, you know, generate me a picture. The example I used was a cat in a party hat. Okay, great, it'll do that. But there's a way of parameterizing what was the thing that it generated a picture of. And cat in party hat is characterized by some vector of numbers, okay? Now you just change those numbers and you get something that is in the mind of the AI is close to a cat in a party hat, but it's not a cat in a party hat. And you can look at these pictures. And there's this kind of island, which I was calling Cat Island, where the things are, to us humans, look kind of like cats. You get off Cat Island, they look just totally weird. So the way I describe it is, it's kind of, there are these concepts like a cat, which are human understandable concepts. And there's this vast interconcept space of all the things that are between the things that we've identified as concepts.
Yes.
So it's as if we've, you know, we've colonized sort of this interconcept space by putting down a few markers of things that we have words for example. And, you know, over time, our sort of civilization will probably get words for other things that right now are part of interconcept space.
Mm.
But it's kind of embarrassing how small the things for which we have words are in the whole space of possibilities, like one part in 10 to the 600 in one very simple way of setting this up. So it's really, you know, what we have humanized is tiny.
Yeah.
And in fact, you know, the story of the development of our science, mathematics, culture, whatever, I see it as being kind of progressive colonization of the Ruliad. We are progressively kind of putting down stakes and giving names to things that we encounter there. And, you know, it's what we have achieved, you know, we've gone a tiny distance. I mean, it's kind of like, if we look at physical space, we're sitting on this particular planet, we've got some spacecraft that go a certain distance away. They don't get very far relative to the, you know, the edge of the universe. That's what we're kind of populating in physical space. It's the same kind of thing in Rulial space. We are kind of progressively, as we have new paradigms, new ways of thinking about things, we're progressively getting further away. But, you know, when you have sort of a computational system like an AI, the AI could just say, well, I'm just going to, you know, do these computations that are out anywhere in Rulial space. And the question is, do we, you know, how do we relate to those? The way I like to think about it these days is, it's kind of like every mind is at a certain point in Rulial space. And minds that are similar, have similar kind of, you know, they are fairly close together. And so communicating from one mind to another, we kind of, you know, there are all these little sort of nerve impulses in our brains that are happening. And then we try and package up the details of those nerve impulses into the language that we speak or whatever. We package it up into concepts. I say something with luck. The thought that I have, which was some kind of set of electrical signals in my brain, I package it up into words. You unpack it. And there's some chance, if I did a good job and so on, that the thing you'll unpack is similar to the thought that I had, even though the way you represent that thought will be vastly different from the way I represent it, just because, you know, the particular details of neurons and what you learnt in your whole life and so on will be different. But, you know, in this rural space of minds, you can kind of say, well, what's, you know, we've got humans who have sort of similar backgrounds and so on, they're fairly close together. Then we get to, you know, the cats and dogs, they're a bit further away. And, you know, we have some sort of alignment with cats and dogs. We have some belief that we understand their emotional states, things like this. Then we get to other computational systems, like the weather is a good example, that are further away in rural space, and where they have all kinds of detailed computational things happening, but they're not well aligned with the way that we think about things and the kind of, you know, our traditional sort of way of interpreting the world and so on. So when it comes to the AIs, an AI is perfectly capable of going out into rural space and being a very alien mind. Mm-hmm. You know, we've gone to a lot of trouble in building LLMs and so on to align the AIs with stuff that we've been doing, you know, in generative AI and so on. The thing that is interesting is that we can get things that aren't just random arrays of pixels. They're actual pictures that remind us of something we think about, so to speak.
Okay, so here's a really good question. Are you or is anyone else, you know, developing a foundational model that is specifically meant to go explore Ruliad space? I guess that kind of brings in something, which is, I think you mentioned in that talk, which is that when it comes back to us, we won't have understand it. So I guess there'll be need to be people who are trained in understanding the alien thoughts. Have you heard of anybody doing this?
Well, I suppose I've been trying to do it all my life, actually, practically, is to, you know, to just go out into the computational universe and see what's there and try to make kind of human level statements about that. Mm. And so, you know, the thing that was, you know, in the 80s, for example, you know, I started doing these computer experiments just, you know, people, I think I probably thought, well, you know, let's like try and make realistic models for things we see in nature. But what I ended up starting to do was just saying, let's imagine a completely artificial universe where we just set the rules up arbitrarily. What does it do? And the first thing people discovered, I discovered, is that it does very complicated things. And then a bunch of great mathematicians actually started working on this and saying, you know, these are such simple systems, we've got to be able to figure out what they do. They spent a few years doing that and eventually gave up. And so one of the big early discoveries of mine was the fact that it didn't work was itself the most significant thing. In other words, the previous sort of scientific idea had been, let's just crush the system and figure out how it works. My kind of realization was that what's really important is this phenomenon I call computational irreducibility, this idea that even though you know the rules for a system, knowing what it can do may be irreducibly difficult. You may just have to follow each step and see what happens.
Oh, okay.
So in other words, that's an example of kind of a human conclusion from something about sort of out there in the computational universe. But now this question of you know, there's a big question of how can you mine the computational universe? Just like in the physical universe, we go out there, we see, oh, we discover, you know, the element molybdenum. And then we discover molybdenum is really useful to alloy with something else to make, you know, some kind of device or something. Well, it's the same thing in the computational universe. We can see all this stuff out there. Now the question is, what's it good for? What do we care about this technologically, so to speak? And that's, you know, that's a sort of a separate branch from what's out there. And this question of sort of, is there a human narrative for what's out there is very related to, do we care? Is it useful technologically, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that's kind of been, so I think, you know, when we ask the question, most engineering that's been done to this point is incremental engineering that's based on building something where you knew what it was going to do. There's a certain amount that I've done, for example, and some other people have done too, where you're just searching the computational universe and you're saying, can I find, you know, you could say, let me develop an algorithm that does this or that. Or you could say, let me search a trillion algorithms, a trillion candidate algorithms, and just see if one of them happens to do what I want or happens to be close enough to what I want. And this is, you know, in a sense, this is an approach that, you know, biological evolution has used approach a bit like this. It has certain objectives, or main objective is survive. You know, and then it's kind of searching the space of possibilities. And that's, you know, that's not what we have tended to do in engineering.
Yeah,
it is, I think, increasingly what one will do in engineering. Now, what does it mean when you just find something out there in the world and, you know, you find it's useful for something? I mean, a great, you know, back in the day, people discovered that donkeys were useful for things. You can use a donkey, even though you don't understand how a donkey works inside. And, you know, the surprise, I suppose, in the Industrial Revolution was that the machines people built were understandable. That wasn't obvious. I mean, it's not, and we've had a period of 150 years or something where, you know, we typically expect to understand the machines we build. But that's, if we do that, then we are denying computational irreducibility. We're saying we'll only have machines, you know, our LLM, we have to understand what it does to the point where it can never do anything bad or whatever else. That's a big constraint on the system to say that it has to be set up in this or that way so that we can understand it. Most of the universe is not understandable to us.
Mm.
Most of them, and most of what, and there are things like the example of the donkey, you know, we can successfully use a donkey, and most of the time the donkey will do what we want until the day when the donkey gets annoyed with us and kicks us or whatever else. But, you know, most of the time it's a big win to use the donkey. And, you know, we could say, no, we're not going to use the donkey. We're just going to sort of roll things along the ground because we can see what's happening then. But that won't work as well. So, you know, this is a big, I mean, it's a big sort of coming societal issue because, you know, when we look at AI and the things that are possible with AI, there's sort of this choice. You can say, I insist on understanding everything about how it works, in which case it's very constrained what it can do. Or you say, I'm going to live with the fact that it's going to be like a donkey and I'm not going to understand everything that it does inside. And I'm going to try and build myself the appropriate kind of, you know, way of living alongside the donkey or alongside the weather or whatever. And, you know, I'll build houses so that I'm not exposed to the weather, but still the weather is doing what it does. And I think, it's, you know, this is kind of and similarly, you know, as we look to the future of kind of, you know, AIs everywhere, so to speak, or computation everywhere, you know, there'll be this whole sort of society of AIs that exists just as the natural world exists. And we get to kind of exist and do our thing around that. And we get to hopefully make use of it for the things we want to achieve. I mean, if you ask the question, you know, you say, okay, the AI is off doing its thing, and the AI is going to just get so much further than the humans got. Mm. It's going to get to the end point of human, you know, of human sort of existence. Well, what does that mean? You know, because the fact is there, you know, the question of where we're going is a matter of choice. There are an infinite number of places to go. We make this choice to go the place where we go. And the AI, the abstract AI, can go to all those places, but it has no criterion other than saying, let me look at what the humans have liked before. Okay, let me try and feed them what they liked before. But that's not, you know, there is an actuality to sort of civilizational history. Mm-hmm. And what actually happens will be what defines sort of how we want things to go. And it's, you know, to know what happened in the past is, you know, we can't, that there's sort of an arbitrariness to where we choose to go. And that arbitrariness will become significant to us once we've gone there. But it's not something where the AI can say, you know, you have to go in this direction. It's, I mean, you know, you could imagine a situation where the AI has, you know, it's inventing lots of artworks, let's say, and humans are looking at it and it's like, I don't think that's any good. I don't like that. But, you know, it could be the case that some artworks invented by AIs, humans will say, "Oh, that's really cool," and everybody will, there'll be a whole sort of thing on the internet where everybody thinks that's, better than cat videos or something. And and the result of that is that that will become a thing, that a direction that makes sense to go, so to speak. So I think, that there is an infiniteness to the Ruliad and to sort of where AIs can in principle go. And there is a kind of a particularness to where, we humans choose to go. And I think, when it comes to sort of, I mean, so one thing that's kind of an interesting sort of philosophical feature is you might say, okay, the future of civilization is going to be expand throughout the Ruliad. Just like we might say, let's expand throughout physical space. Let's send out spacecraft and go and, whatever. Physical space is actually very small compared to Rulial space. So if we really want to take over the universe, we have to not only send out our progeny, so to speak, to all of physical space, but we also have to populate all of Rulial space. So and we do that by kind of sort of understanding more, having more kind of ways to think about the universe. Kind of paradigms are the kind of analog of sort of understanding a new paradigm is kind of like the analog of that. Understanding a new paradigm gives you a sort of a different point of view on the Ruliad. Just as if you take a spacecraft and you take it to Alpha Centauri or something, you'll have a different point of view on how to look at the universe, so to speak, because you're in a different place in physical space.
So
So
I've got an interest. I wanna go into this point because as you've been talking, this question has been coming up in my mind, and it relates to the structure of personal computing at the very beginning when they developed this idea of artificial intelligence. There's one camp that said, okay, we're going to try artificial intelligence and really create a whole other intelligence that's alien to human beings. And then there's another camp that's the augmentation camp, which is the, we're going to augment human abilities. And now this current AI seems like it's a bit of both. I'd be curious about what your take on that is. But there's also this sense that some people are going to want to merge with the AI. I'm not sure if that's physically possible. Maybe you have some insight into that. And so once they merge with the AI, I guess to what degree won't they be able to basically then be the AI and also explore Ruliad space in this way that's like accelerated?
Yeah, I mean, well, okay. So let's see how to unpack that. I mean, in this question of, okay, what will it feel like if you've connected your brain directly to a computational system, AI, whatever? I mean, one thing to clarify, because it's, the term AI has kind of changed its meaning over the last, 70 years or whatever. And it's there is sort of what one can think of as formal computation. That is, you take these steps, you use some rule, you apply the rule over and over again, you generate some result. That is sort of what computation is about. What people these days typically mean by AI is neural nets, where you train something from some training set rather than you specify rules and then you let them run. The fact is that the modern version of AI is pretty similar, probably, to how humans unaidedly think about things. The idea of computation with rules and so on is a formalization of the world that started with things like logic, developed with things like mathematics and so on. That is a thing which goes beyond what humans, it's kind of a superpower for humans to be able to do things computationally and formally. And it's something where you can say, well, can I just figure out how this mechanical system will work by just pure thought, just reasoning this, that, and the other. This pushes on that, and so this, whatever. Well, the big thing that started 300 years ago was people realizing, no, you can just write down equations, solve the equations, and you're done. And that is a thing which gives you a much taller computational tower than the things that are sort of pure human thought or pure modern neural net type AI. So there's this thing that, what we are now beginning to be able to do is to automate a lot of things which we humans can do kind of just off the top of our head. What we have done in the past, and what I've spent lots of effort on, is kind of taking what we can formalize and being able to build these huge towers that go far beyond what an unaided human mind can do. And so what we're seeing right now is, kind of the LLM, generative AI sort of story is like unaided human minds. Things I've been building for many years give one this kind of link between what human minds think about and the sort of superpower of computation. And that's something that is a that goes beyond what minds normally do. And so that has given us, that gives us this kind of new kind of new superpower that is different from unaided minds. So we can talk about sort of what happens if you have the computational superpower connected to kind of our brains. We can talk about what happens if you have the AI that's just kind of like our brains, but maybe running a bit faster and with a bit more memory and things like this. And those are, I think, slightly different. I mean, I think that the because the computational story is a very non-human story. It's a very, that allows you to kind of go a very long way, but in a way that isn't something that we humans immediately follow. Now, I think so, but this question of how, and I think that the real right now, the sort of powerful thing to do is connect your neural netish AI to computational intelligence, so to speak. That's kind of the whole story of Wolfram Language and so on. I mean, but the whole story of our Wolfram Language effort, my effort for the last 40 years or so, is basically find precise ways to describe the world computationally. Find a computational way of representing, cities and chemicals and sort of algorithmic procedures and things like this. And that gives you this kind of superpower that once you've got things represented in that form, you can go and build these big towers and figure out lots of things. So as humans, my big effort is to create a language that we humans can think in terms of, but where the computers can kind of go and zoom off and build these big towers. It used to be the case that most of our users were humans. It's in the last year, many of our users are now AIs.
So okay, so let's talk about that because that is so interesting. I loved how when I first started using ChatGPT, the first thing that came up was Wolfram Alpha. One of the major problems that I'm having is that I can't, I don't understand enough about computational thinking, and I don't understand enough about business problems and transforming them into computational thinking. So I don't know how to utilize Wolfram Alpha. If there is any, do you guys have any consultants or anybody who teaches people how? Yeah,
Oh,
okay,
yes.
yeah.
Yes, we absolutely do. Yeah, and we have a, I mean, that's a common, this whole question about how do you take your company as it is and kind of make it computable? That's a very typical, and when you succeed, it's a superpower. You get to just do amazing things. And we have a solutions team that works with companies to do that. My own, I've spent, I suppose we were spoiled because back when Mathematica first came out in 1988, there was a lot of pent-up demand among scientists for a way to do computation that they could do with their own fingers, so to speak, rather than sort of delegating
Yeah,
it to a programmer
interesting.
who would do the wrong thing and so on. And that first set of users were very sophisticated, as in they, once we said, here's how you can think about this computationally, they were like, okay, I get it. And they can immediately do things. In I think the big story in more recent times has been that there's the value of thinking about things computationally and formulating it in computational language is extremely high. But it's a funny thing because there are all these people now who are programmers in C++, Java, Python, whatever else. And the typical thing that a person who is a programmer in those, I mean, those languages are primarily intended to provide a kind of wrapper around what computers intrinsically do. That, our language, the idea is take the world as it is and represent it computationally. In the case of those languages, it's take computers, what they do, and try and provide sort of a way to tell the computers what to do at that level. And so, a typical programmer will say, well, I've got this project to do, and I'm going to spend a month just writing code. And then that when that's finished, then there's this brief moment where they have to sort of think computationally about what to do next. What we've tried to do is to automate that whole thing about, you know, and then you spend a month writing code. If we've done our job correctly, we have sort of functions in language that just do that a lot of the thing you might spend a week trying to write some piece of code and hook it together with something else. And so it has this funny feature that then most of the effort is actually doing the computational thinking to figure out what you want to do. I mean, it's kind of the story, you know, it's also the story of AI that most of the, you know, the human component is, so what do you want to do? Then you can automate the doing of it. And if we've done our job properly, we have automated a lot of the computational doing of things. But then as sort of the programmer, if you call it that, there's this kind of this thing, which was the moment of what you're going to do, figuring out what you're going to do, that becomes most of your job. And the part of your job that's just like, oh, I just crank out some code, just isn't there. And people have realized that you know, with LLMs writing sort of boilerplate code and so on, that's become, you know, that's beginning to become obvious. I mean, the LLMs do, you know, if you have a low-level language where there's an awful lot of kind of boilerplate, where it's just like, oh, every time you write a function like that, you've got seven lines that do this, right? To me, as a language designer, that's a failure in the language, because why do you have to write the seven lines of boilerplate code? It's like, why didn't we just provide as a function the thing you want to do? And that's kind of been the story of my last 40 years, is trying to do that.
And do you think that that is the, because that's the system in which we live in right now. Most, I, it didn't even occur to me until you told me that you can essentially just, like, why not just create the boilerplate, and that's not necessarily boilerplate, but like the code to do the functions that all these programmers all over the world are figuring out. And do you think that that system is just a failure of imagination on humanity?
Well, I mean, I like to think, you know, we've just spent the last 40 years building that, you know, trying to figure out what are, I mean, just like in human language, okay, we come up with words for things. Concepts that we care about, we come up with words for. In computational language, concepts that we care about, we come up with functions for. And, you know, in Wolfram language, there are about 7,000 sort of functions. In English, there are 40,000 words. Functions are a little bit bigger in their sort of domain than words are. So it's kind of a, you know, it's sort of a vaguely comparable amount of sort of stuff, cognitive stuff, so to speak. And, you know, I think the dynamics of the whole thing are, it's, you know, doing something that is sort of thinking is something that people find, you know, it takes effort to do thinking. And so if a large part of the story is think about what you want to do, define what you want to do, clarify what you want to do. I mean, my goal in building our computational language is to provide sort of a notation for thinking about things computationally. It's kind
Interesting.
of a repeat of what happened 500 years ago when people invented things like mathematical notation. Before that time, people, if you want to talk about math, you talked about it in terms of words. Then people invented plus signs and equal signs and all those kinds of things. And that led to the development of algebra and calculus and so on. Those would have been very hard to develop if, and very hard to think about if you were kind of sort of discussing math just in terms of words. And so, kind of my goal has been to build a language, a computational language, where it's possible to think about things computationally in the language. And it's pretty cool that that works. I mean, you know, there are lots of people who do that and really think in our computational language. I think I'm one of them, but it's really it's kind of fun when you get to the point where you're fluent enough in the language that you can start typing it before you know what you're going to say, kind of like when you speak a foreign human language, so to speak. And that, you know, what's then important is that the constructs of the computational language lead you to think about things in a way that's sort of clear and computational. And then you can build these big towers, and that's, you know, if you're setting up your company that way, so to speak, and you're representing kind of the things you do in your company in this kind of symbolic computational way, it's really super powerful. But it takes, you know, I would say that there is a sort of a hole right now in there, that there are people, you know, there are people who sort of intrinsically grok the idea of thinking about things computationally. And there are people, you know, over the course of the last 37 years, there are a lot of people who built careers in all kinds of areas. You know, basically, for every field X, there either is now or is going to be a computational X. And it's kind of cool that that's some, I've seen a lot of people have used our computational language to build computational X for some X. And they were the first people there, so to speak. And they built these sort of amazing things in these areas. And that's kind of a, that's what becomes possible. And it's just like in the past, there was sort of mathematical X for various X. Computational X is a much broader story. But the question is, how do you learn to sort of think computationally? Because it's not, what you learn in computer science school is not really that. An awful lot of the time in computer science school, you're basically just learning to program, which is sort of a different thing and that. But this question about how do you formulate things in computational terms, that's not something that people have been familiar with. I mean, it's like, how do you formulate things in logical terms? How do you formulate things in mathematical terms? These are things where people are much more tend to teach the mechanics of what you do than to teach how do you take what you were thinking about and formulate it that way. So, in fact, one of my current projects, which I wish I wasn't doing myself, but it looks like I end up having to do it myself, is to kind of write some kind of book course thing about sort of introduction to computational thinking, whose goal is to sort of explain how to do this. And one thing to realize about explaining how to do it is, it's kind of like anything where you say, I'm going to explain how to think in a certain way. That is potentially a very doomed activity because it's kind of like you give very abstract things, nobody understands what you're talking about. So the thing that one realizes is there just are, it's like you take look at the things that exist in the world and you say, how do we think about each of these kinds of things computationally? And kind of you build up this kind of set of factual knowledge about how this was thought about computationally, that was thought about computationally. And then when you get to take the thing that you're thinking about, you can kind of connect it to those kind of facts about how things worked. And each of those sort of facts introduces some kind of, some sort of piece of that fills in the picture of sort of what this notion of computational thinking really is. But I want to come back to something you were talking about before about AI versus kind of brains and so on. And I had the experience recently, people have been making sort of bots of me because I have this, because I do a bunch of live streaming and I answer lots of questions in live streams and so on, there's 50 million words of me yakking that's out there. Okay. So it's a lot. And I also have been a person who's kept a lot of data about myself that's not yet used to train a public bot, but we've been experimenting with it ourselves. I have every email I've sent and received for 30 years. I've got every keystroke I've typed for 20 something years. I've got, a huge amount of detail about me. And, it's probably enough that you could reconstruct me to high precision, so to speak, without having any of the actual brain available. And so that's some but it's sort of interesting as you start thinking, well, there could be a bot of me that's pretty accurate. How do I feel about myself when there's a bot of me? And I don't know. I'm just, this is a new experience.
Oh, interesting. So that's a good question. I've been doing a lot of interviews on people who are building what are being called decision autopilots instead of the copilot, which is most of us are familiar using AI in terms of coding or other things. Like, what if you could actually have the autopilot going on in the background? And what that just made me think is, what if you combine the fact that somebody, you guys are creating a large language model on you. And then you bring in this idea that it can actually take actions as well. And then not only do you have a bot that can actually speak like you, but you have a bot that can actually make decisions like you. Do you think that that
Yes,
world exists? And will it
surely.
soon?
Yeah, it'll exist. I mean, the question of what, how one feels about that is a complicated question. And, it's like, what will the real use case be? What will the, I mean, that's one branch. The other branch is the greater symbiosis with your computational system, your AI, your bot, whatever else. I mean, for me, when I think about things, I'm typically thinking in this computational language that I just spent years building, and I'm typically thinking by typing. And, I'm creating some, Wolfram notebook or something of the things I'm thinking about. That's that, I have attempted a sort of symbiosis with this computer. Physics project is kind of an example of something that would have been just outright impossible without that kind of symbiosis. I mean, it's kind of the story of my life, I suppose, has been, do science, figure out how to build some technology from that, build the technology as tools, figure out how that lets one do more science, and iterate about five times so far. But I think that's so there's one thing is kind of this symbiosis. And for me, for example, it's kind of like, I have these easily searchable archives of kind of everything I've done for the last 30 something years. And that's really useful. I mean, I think I have a pretty decent human memory, but me plus my artificial memory is really very good. And that that's another kind of thing. Now, as you start thinking about, well, what if I kind of, graft that into my, if it's not just fingers and eyes, but it's a more direct neural connection and so on. I don't think that's quite as exciting as you might think it is, because I think that you have to have, just like we have a user interface that is the thing that makes it convenient for us to get into our brains, the thing that we just saw on the screen. When we have a direct neural connection, we're going to have a neural user interface, because it's still going to be the case that we've got to get into our stream of consciousness, so to speak, the things that are going on. And that requires, it's a different type of interface. It's not like, oh, now you click the button or something like this. It's some other kind of thing that we don't yet have a good way to describe. But it's, and in fact, it sort of forces us to think about, one of the fundamental problems of neuroscience is there's a level of talking about neuroscience that's just neurons firing and so on. And there's a level of talking about neuroscience that's people saying things or doing crazy things or whatever else. And the question is, there's a sort of an intermediate description language or description layer of neuroscience, which is kind of like not at the level of just individual neuron firings that all seem to be kind of random, and much below the level of, and then I say this word type thing. And that's something we don't know. That's one of these places where we'd like to, is that a humanizable kind of thing? Is there a sort of a humanizable layer? But that's what we need if we're going to build a neural user interface. We need to plug into that layer. Because if there isn't a layer like that, then we're stuck having to package up ideas using things like human language, visual kinds of representations. That really, if there's no lower level that is in any way robust, then all we can do is use our eyes and our ears and so on to suggest the information. And anything lower level is just going to be sort of incoherent to us. My guess is there is an intermediate level, and that's one of the things that maybe that we now can sort of scientifically start to discover. There's this whole kind of LLM science that you can imagine doing, which is kind of the natural science of LLMs. How do we think about LLMs? Is there a kind of a humanized representation of what's going on? And I think there is a bit of it. I think, one thing I long thought exists is this kind of a way of constructing language that goes beyond the kind of pure syntactic grammar. Like we've known, a typical sentence in English will be, noun, verb, noun type structure, but there are many sentences we can construct. I don't know, the mouse ate the moon. That sentence, while it's perfectly grammatically correct, doesn't really mean much in anything beyond sort of some poetic sense. So there's sort of a construction kit of what sentences not only make, syntactically work, but also actually can mean something. And I think it's something actually Aristotle started on this and came up with logic as one kind of construction of things that mean something. He might have gone on and studied more detailed categories and so on, but he didn't. And 2,000 years later, the LLMs, I think, kind of show us there is a way to do that. And by the way, once we have that construction kit, a lot of the magic of LLMs will seem a lot less magic, because it's kind of like once we can make a construction kit where we say, look, just like we can construct sentences that are syntactically correct rather easily. We can't do the magic, the seemingly magic thing that the LLMs could do, which is construct sentences which are semantically correct. But that's something that I think there will be a much simpler, kind of much more structured way of doing so that you say, I'm going to throw out a sentence and it's going to be potentially meaningful, that you'll be able to do. And, and I think that the story will end up being a lot of that. That's kind of the thing that we should have figured out sometime in the last 2,000 years, but didn't. And then there's kind of the next sort of piece of this is, and then there's the kind of computational part that we kind of, you know, build this sort of formalized way of thinking about things that is something quite different from the way that we intrinsically think. And that's something that allows us to sort of go in a different direction than we've been able to go before. But I think this whole question of what's it going to feel like as we get to make more tightly integrated use of kind of computation, AI, and so on, is an interesting question. I think, you know, it raises questions like, well, is there going to be anything for the humans to do anymore? You know, it's kind of interesting that in our efforts in computational language, we have provided, we've greatly automated many things that people could do. A lot of people, you know, use it, but a lot of people don't use it. A lot of people are like, well, I'm just going to do it the old way of, you know, I'm going to write that, you know, that Java code. And even though that the week that I spent doing this, I could have spent 15 minutes, it's like, but I'm going to write the Java code anyway, because that's what I'm kind of used to doing. Now, sometimes things happen that way just because, the world changes slowly and people have learned one set of things and they don't learn a new set of things. But there's also a certain comfort in sort of doing this, oh, I know how to do this, I can just do it, and it's, you know, a comfortable way to make a living type thing. I think that, but it also tends to be the case that when things get automated, sort of lots of new possibilities are opened up. So I tend to think that as you see sort of, it's certainly the history of jobs in the world that, you know, at first everybody was sort of doing agriculture and trying to grow enough food. And then that got automated. And then many other things got opened up that became possible because that was automated. And then there are many choices of what people could do. And people are then there's sort of work for people to do because there are lots of these choices. I think in modern times, you know, the fact that sort of AI is coming in, computation is coming in, that opens up new things that you can do in the world. I mean, you can be a generative AI artist now. You couldn't be that before. You can do things, you know, you can be a maker of certain, you know, artistic things, whatever else, that you would have otherwise, it would be a painstaking thing to do it. Now you can, you know, you can automate that. Similarly, a lot of things, you know, that become possible with computational language, you don't have to do all those details yourself. You can sort of stand on this much taller platform to get things done. And that enables a bunch of new things that one might do. Now the next question is, well, what do we choose to do as a species? You know, we could say, video games are the greatest thing ever, and we're just going to play video games. Or we could say, you know, what we really care about is the number of likes that we get in some social media platform. You know, that wasn't a thing back in the day. That's a thing of modern times. And similarly, this question of sort of the evolution of what we think is important is something which is kind of a story of the development of our civilization. That's not something that's kind of, it's not something technologically, it's something enabled by technology, but it's not something sort of mathematically derivable. What will we decide is important? So, you know, I think it's for the world at large, this kind of all these questions about, you know, we will exist just like we exist sort of in alongside nature. Mm. We will exist alongside the AIs. And this question of sort of how do we deal with that? We get to do natural science about nature that helps us coexist with nature. We'll get to do natural science about the AIs that lets us sort of coexist with the AIs. And, you know, there'll be certain things we can understand, there'll be certain things we can't understand, and we'll kind of build our, you know, personal workflows to deal with the things that we can understand, for example.
Yeah, interesting. So it'll be like a huge kind of like fruit tree that will continuously give fruit, and we'll just be picking at the fruit from the fruit tree of AI.
Yeah, and it's a question of what fruit do we want to pick? Mm. And, you know, we might, and some things that, you know, clearly clearly many things can go wrong, so to speak, as in, we think we're doing the right thing, and turns out, because we want to make more paper clips or whatever, and turns out we all get turned into paper clips because that. But my own guess is that a lot of those concerns are a bit overrated, in the sense that there's sort of an equilibrium that, happens, particularly when you have this whole kind of collection of AIs. It's kind of like if you have the one all-powerful AI, and we're all kind of praying to the AI type thing or whatever, that's a weird situation and a quite unstable situation. By the time you have this whole ecosystem of AIs interacting with AIs and so on, I think, I don't know, but I think it becomes a more stable story. And the question then is, human society has evolved in a certain way to, it has its splurting out of craziness from time to time, but human society has fundamentally been reasonably stable over the course of human history. And, the question is, what will happen to AI society? Will that similarly, is this, will it, and maybe one of its splurtings out will be strong enough that it'll wipe us out. I don't know. But my guess is that there's a certain equilibrium that will be reached. And it's an interesting question. It's kind of like you can think about all the kind of questions of political philosophy and so on that have been thought about for humans. You think about them for the AIs or for humans interacting with the AIs. And, at first, I think there's a great need to figure all that stuff out. I think that, a few hundred years ago, 300, 400 years ago, was the time when literacy was coming in, communication was becoming easier, and modern democracy got invented. And that was a kind of a way to make society sort of operate. And now we have a very different situation with different technological capabilities. And it's like, what do we do? And, you can start doing little thought experiments, like one that I was sort of exploring at one point was the kind of promptocracy thought experiment. That is, instead of people, back in the day, voting, putting a check mark somewhere, that was the thing that could readily be aggregated and sort of mathematically aggregated. But the other alternative is everybody describes their prompt for how they want the world to be. And then you feed all the prompts into a big AI, and every decision that you're going to make, you kind of just ask the AI, so what should we do? And you can kind of say, well, what do we do if 80% of the people said they want this and 20% that they really don't want it? Do we go with that or not? Well, you can kind of recurse, and those very prompts can describe the question of kind of how you want sort of the split of, oh, 20% are unhappy, 5% are really unhappy, 10% are really happy, and so on. What do you want to have happen there? But I think, there are lots of things that can go wrong, but that's an example of a kind of a something to think about that is a little different, made possible by kind of modern, by the fact that it's not just numbers now. It's not just we can start sort of thinking in terms of what are these more kind of conceptual combining thoughts in a way we haven't been able to do before. We've been able to combine numbers before, but we haven't been able to combine kind of this much fuzzier kind of patterns of thought. But I think, there are a lot of questions like that. There are a lot of questions about in the kind of society of AIs, what do you do when one of the AIs goes rogue, so to speak? How do you, and is it in the interest, is it an inevitable thing? A bit like, evolution by natural selection. There's a certain inevitability to evolution by natural selection. It couldn't work a different way. And so the question is, in society, is there a certain inevitability to a certain degree of stability about how things work? And for example, if you've got the rogue AI, one of the things that might happen is you've got all these other AIs, and they say, are we going to trust the rogue AI? Well, the problem is if all the other AIs have this big network of things that they're doing, and they're kind of in the end a sort of an edge to that whole network where the AIs have to interface with the outside world or with humans or whatever else. And then they're like, well, do I want to be involved with that rogue AI? Wait a minute, that's going to affect my ability to do this external interface. Let me, what I should do is ostracize the rogue AI. And so, you might have said, look, let's, the rogue AI does something bad. We should do what we do with human laws, and we should say, let's, punish the perpetrator, so to speak. But in a sense, by ostracizing the rogue AI, It's kind of like you could as well be, putting it in prison or whatever. It doesn't, you're removing it from society in a way that is, and there's, I think that this is one of these things. I haven't worked this all the way through, but that's an example of a kind of a way to think. You might think you're never going to be able to have something that works like human law, where you say you shouldn't do the wrong thing because if you do the wrong thing, bad things will happen to you. But that couldn't work with AIs because AIs don't intrinsically care whether bad things happen to them. But the point is that operationally, it doesn't really matter. Because if operationally you're isolating that AI, that is like isolating the human. I mean, it's kind of like the fact that we think that humans, we set these things up so that, I mean, we have this assumption that other humans feel what we feel. We don't yet have that assumption about AIs, but it is an assumption for humans. I mean, it's like we can't get inside anybody else's mind. We're just assuming that their mind is similar to our mind. And so, we see certain things happening. We know certain things are going on sort of externally. I mean, that's so it's but I don't know how that's really going to play out as we start to sort of more and more anthropomorphize the AIs that we're dealing with. But my guess is that a big piece of the story will be kind of the society of AIs operating somewhat autonomously and interfacing with us. A lot of things about the AIs will happen much faster than we think. I mean, for example, for an AI that might think a million times faster than we do, even the notion of, coming back to physics, the notion of physical space won't make as much sense. Because if we look around, you're in a room, it might be, 20 feet across. Light that comes to you from the other side of the room reaches you in a microsecond, but your brain doesn't respond for many milliseconds. So for you, it's kind of like there's a state of space that you get to see. That's the instantaneous state of space. And then you get to sort of see the movie of it progressing through time. But if you're an AI that's thinking a million times faster, you're seeing all those photons arriving. And the fact that those aggregate into something which is kind of this notion of space is not obvious. It's something that's a very human, from the way humans see the universe, the existence of space and time is kind of inevitable. But the way that an alien mind sees the universe is not so inevitable. And what the obvious sort of idealizations, simplifications that an alien mind might make might be very different. I mean, it's an interesting question. For an AI that lives on the internet and all it knows is the connectivity of the internet, what does it think is the structure of space? Because all it knows is, it's connected to this place and that place. Or, to the AI that is sort of reading the IoT data of every device, what is its experience of the world? Because we're used to having a limited experience with, our sort of personal eyes and ears type thing, and it's not clear how that works out, but I think, I mean, in a lot of the question of sort of how things develop, I think is it's very much on us, kind of what develops, and it's not, I don't think there's an inevitable trajectory that is kind of it has to happen this way, so to speak.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for this interview. Is there anything that you want my listeners to know about what you're working on? Anything that you're working on at anybody, what's going on there?
Well, let's see. You want to follow what I do, you can go and look at, writings.stephenwolfram.com. And occasionally I write things that I have a terrible habit of writing rather long things, but they sometimes turn into books even. But I've been oh, let's see, I mean, right now there's a lot of things happening with our physics project, and if we're lucky, we'll be able to do what people were able to do 100 years ago and discover. 100 years ago, people discovered that molecules actually exist. And that was discovered actually 120 years ago. That was discovered when people saw Brownian motion, little grains of pollen being kicked around discretely by water molecules. The question is, will we be able to discover in our time the analog of Brownian motion for physical space? And that would kind of reveal the discreteness of physical space. And it's looking promising that there may be some effects. I mean, we may be unlucky. It may be, yes, there is an effect, but we're 100 years away from being able to detect something that small. Or we may be lucky, and it may be a quite short-term thing to be able to say, gosh, physics, has these features that really plug into this model that we built. So that's one thing. I think another thing, so that's kind of a coming attraction, not yet here. I think the other thing that we didn't really quite cover, but is really kind of interesting, I think, is sort of the inevitability of the universe. That is, why do we have certain laws of physics, and one might have thought these laws of physics are just the way they happen to be. Like we have law of gravity, we have quantum mechanics, we have the second law of thermodynamics. Those are the three big kind of theories that emerged in the 20th century. And why do they work that way? Is it just somebody wheeled them in, and or somehow the universe wheeled those in and happens to work that way? That's what I had always assumed, but it isn't true. I mean, what seems to be true is that from this Rouliad, which is the sort of inevitable sort of assembly of all these computational possibilities, then for observers like us, observers who are computationally bounded, observers who believe that we are persistent in time and have the single thread of experience, it is inevitable that those three theories emerge the way they emerge. So to an alien observer, the theories of physics might be different, but to us, those theories are inevitable. In other words, it's not that we don't, you might have said, well, general relativity, theory of gravity, theory of space-time just is the way it is because it happens to be that way. But what we're realizing is, given the way we are as observers, it is inevitable that that's what we must perceive. And so that's kind of a big deal because it means we can derive why the universe is the way it is, which is just something that seemed very far away from what was possible in science. So that's one thing that I think is kind of interesting.
But
Yeah.
wouldn't the observer or wouldn't the aliens be observers as well? But maybe they'd be bound in different ways.
Well, okay, so is the weather an observer? Maybe yes.
Yeah, got it.
Yeah. But we don't, it's a question of how aligned are we? By the time you're not computationally bounded, for example, very different from the human experience. You don't get to have a finite number of words in your language. You're taught, you've got an infinite set of things that are possible and so on. It's a very different, very non-human experience. But what's not obvious is, we humans have many detailed features, like we have two eyes and things like this, but it's not important. That's not important for deriving these core laws of physics. What's important is much coarser facts about us as observers, and facts that transcend the details of whether we're looking at the world with our own eyes or through a telescope or whatever else. And so that the fact that from that alone you can derive laws of physics is, I think it is, in terms of the sort of arc of the history of theoretical science, it's kind of an important thing. And so that's one thing. I think another thing sort of to highlight is sort of this computational irreducibility, its significance for kind of the future of decisions to be made in society, and this relationship. I think the story of a lot of science is this tension between computational irreducibility of what systems do and computational boundedness of what we observe about those systems. And that's kind of the big tension in science. And sort of a version of that is also the big tension for the development of kind of how we think about AI and what AI is going to do. I think it's also the thing that's been really, really interesting is that the sort of formalism we've developed for our physics project looks like it's applicable to a bunch of other things, like biology, like economics. And so these questions about sort of there's lots of computational irreducibility, there's certain sort of pockets of reducibility. How do those relate to things like economics? I mean, in economics, you can kind of vaguely think about sort of economics as this giant network of transactions between different agents in an economic system. And then Why is there anything simple that you can say? For example, why can you talk about things like, oh, there's a price for that? It's not obvious you can talk about that. Could just be everybody has to make lots of barter transactions. But the fact that there is an emergence of things like price, I think, is very related to the fact that there's an emergence of things like space from the kind of microscopic details of all of these different sort of things that events that go on in the underlying structure of this network that represents space. So it's there's a lot of connections that where these connections really get power is because the physics, we're pretty sure physics works this way, and we know a lot about physics. And so you can start saying things like, oh, I think I can see the analog of an event horizon or a black hole or some relativistic effect. I think I can see the analog of that in this economic system that has the same sort of underlying formalism. We're not there yet. That's still a coming attraction. I think that's one thing. I think that the whole story of kind of computational language, computational thinking, this is it's kind of that's been a long running story. But the LLMs help sort of emphasize that, more can be automated than you thought could be automated. And this is the way that humans really sort of define what they want. It's kind of like you can write, your contract, you can write in legalese, you can write it in computational language. If you write it in computational language, it's very sort of very definite what you want to say. So I suppose there's a few things. I don't know. I think the in terms of what people, yeah, well, check out the website if you're interested in my life and times. I suppose the other thing I should say is that I do a crazy amount of live streaming, and one of the things I do, which is sort of an unusual thing, I think almost uniquely unusual actually thing for tech people, is that when we're designing Wolfram Language, we do that as kind of an open process, and we live stream a bunch of our, in fact, I like did one a couple of hours ago, live stream internal software design reviews and so on.
Wait,
And that's
where can you find that? Or where can
on
where? On
YouTube and other
YouTube.
people.
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, it's there's an outrageous number of hundreds, maybe even thousands of hours of that by now. It's an interesting, it's funny because I've been doing it for like 5 or 6 years now, and I think I'm still unique in doing that. And it's kind of surprising that, for example, in both the tech industry and in academia, people, maybe they just aren't as crazy as I am, that or they aren't as well, I don't know if it's competent, arrogant, whatever, that it's just like, I'm just going to do what I do. If people, if I say stupid things, well, I say stupid things, and that's the way it goes. But that's some so. But I also have been doing, as I say, part of the reason that you can train a bot on me is because I've been doing many Q&A live streams, hundreds and hundreds of hours of those, that for me are actually, they're very educational for me. Hopefully they're educational for other people too. But for me, people ask all sorts of interesting things. And for me, I think I gradually get to be a better explainer of things, and so that's been super helpful to me. In very recent and very current times, I put out a series of books about different things. I happen to have one. If this shows up before April 8th, you can check out this book. And you're in the U.S., you can check out this book that I wrote about predicting the eclipse. That is about the interesting history. I mean, we have a website that hopefully will predict when the eclipse will arrive to within a couple of seconds, wherever you are. And it's a long story. It's a sort of 3,000-year story of how one got to the point where you can actually predict this. It's an interesting story because it really scans through a lot of kind of the different stages of mathematical and computational thinking in history. That people, I mean, it used to be the case in the 1700s and 1800s, the theory of the moon was kind of the holy grail of mathematical physics. I don't know what the holy grail is. Maybe it's finding the fundamental theory of physics. Maybe it'll have to change now because we think we've now done that. I mean, it's a thing to, worth commenting, and it relates to some of the other things we've talked about, that just because you found the fundamental theory of physics doesn't mean physics is finished. Just like the, in other words, just like there are always more things to invent. Given one of these computationally irreducible systems, it will always have surprises for you. There is no limit. You can always keep going. You can always do more things. And the question is, do you care about the new things you're doing? But there are always more things to do. So it's not, science is not ended, so to speak. The science that is possible goes on forever. The science that we care about might end, but the science, although it's one of the things about society is we might say, okay, we're going to set things up this way. We're going to define these kind of rules for the AIs or something. We're going to, we're going to have a programmed society that just works this way. In the end, computational irreducibility will bite you, because in the end, something will happen that goes outside of your rule set, so to speak, and then you'll have to change that. And it's a common story in the history of human society that kind of, when people have said, we're going to define what happens and we're going to have everything very controlled, that doesn't usually work very well, because things happen that you didn't expect, and your sort of predefinition isn't really enough. Anyway, so many things to talk about, but
Yeah, and I would love to do another one and go into a lot more of the different stuff we talked about. But thank you so much for coming on the show.
thanks.
Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoyed this episode. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Stuart Alsop III. Also, don't forget to subscribe on Spotify or iTunes for every weekly episode that I publish on Monday mornings. Hope you have a great day.